Kwazumi and Mr. Bush sit down for talks. Experts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta will vote this morning on who should get a vaccine against a virus that can cause cervical cancer. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
The sexually transmitted human papillomavirus causes cervical cancer and genital warts. One vaccine has just become available, another is expected to win approval soon. Now the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices of the CDC will vote on whether young girls should be vaccinated before they become sexually active. States, school districts, and insurers are likely to make policy based on the committee's decision. An anti-vaccine group is claiming the vaccine has not been proven safe for young girls, but there's been little opposition from conservative groups, despite their emphasis on promoting abstinence or sexual fight to prevent the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
A Senate committee has approved compromise legislation that will require makers of diet supplements to report bad reactions to the federal government. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
A 1994 law specifically exempted makers of diet supplements from having to meet the same safety and effectiveness requirements as prescription drugs. That's caused a lot of complaints from consumer advocates, particularly after serious health problems linked to the supplement ephedra. The new bill breaks a years-long deadlock, in a way. Supplements still won't have to prove they're safe and effective, but makers will have to report so-called adverse reactions to the Food and Drug Administration. The reports won't necessarily mean the supplements are unsafe, but they will let the agency see if a pattern emerges. With support from Republicans, Democrats, the industry, and consumer groups, the bill is expected to win swift passage. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Residents of nearly 100 U.S. cities will now have their air mail flown by UPS. The Postal Service today announced a deal with the Atlanta-based carrier. Joshua Leves reports.
Under the agreement, UPS will fly domestic air mail in and out of 98 cities, a big jump from the 16 cities it currently handles. The world's largest package carrier says it will use its existing planes to handle all that mail. The two are rivals for the package delivery business, but the Postal Service has a $1.3 billion deal with another rival, Federal Express, to move packages. The new agreement puts UPS in a position to carve out more of the mail market. In a statement, UPS CEO Mike Eskew said his company is excited about expanding its relationship with the Postal Service. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
Federal investigators allege that BP traders illegally tried to manipulate propane prices in 2004. Investigators are accusing BP's North American arm of cornering the American propane market to drive heating costs higher for rural consumers. Details of the alleged scheme are outlined in a civil lawsuit the government has filed against BP. The Justice Department says a former BP propane trader who's pleaded guilty to trying to manipulate prices has agreed to cooperate with investigators. BP denies any wrongdoing. A spokesman says they will contest the charges in court. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Susan Stamberg. The Supreme Court today ruled against President Bush on the war crime trials of Guantanamo detainees. The justices ruled 5-3 that the president overstepped his authority in ordering the trials, which the court says are illegal under U.S. law and the Geneva Conventions. NPR's Nina Totenberg joins us from the court. Nina, tell us what the justices said that the president did wrong.
Well, the big thing he did wrong was to not go to Congress to ask for permission to have these tribunals and to use certain procedures. Justice John Paul Stevens, writing for the five-justice majority, has issued a very lengthy opinion, some 73 pages, and there are impassioned dissents from Justices Scalia and Thomas, who both spoke from the bench this morning. Essentially, Justice Stevens said that the president can order military tribunals under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but unless he gets specific authorization from Congress or make some sort of showing of necessity, which he didn't do here. He can't deviate in a substantial way from the way military trials are normally conducted, and the president has done that here. He has set up a system, Justice Stevens pointed out, where the accused can be excluded from the trial, doesn't know the evidence against him in some cases. In fact, as Justice Stevens observed, in this case was involving Osama bin Laden's driver, he had already been excluded from just the jury selection in his trial. The way this system is set up has given the appointing, what's called the appointing authority, Justice Stevens said, such extraordinary power that the president, through his appointed individuals, ends up sort of as judge, jury, and executioner, and he can't do that, certainly not without congressional authority, which he doesn't have.
Yeah, but now, Nina, does this mean there will be no trials for the detainees at Guantanamo?
Well, it may mean that unless the president can now goes to Congress to get specific authority. One of the things that has happened in this case is that Congress has basically abdicated any responsibility to set up procedures. There haven't been hearings. There haven't been any, you know, any attempt to do that. The president hasn't suggested a model. Congress hasn't had hearings on any sort of models. And that may now have to happen. What the court said is you can detain these people as long as hostilities continue, but you can't impose criminal punishment based on a trial system that violates our laws.
Yes. And now at the center of this case, a Yemeni citizen, as you said, he was the bin Laden's driver. His name is Salim Ahmed Hamdan. Tell us about this case, his case.
Well, he was charged with conspiracy to violate the laws of war. Justice Stevens said, writing for himself and three other justices, a plurality, that even that charge is a violation of the Geneva Conventions, because the Geneva Conventions don't recognize conspiracy, that they require overt acts, and that nothing that Hamdan is charged with doing, driving Osama bin Laden, helping to move equipment around and military supplies, that none of that is considered an overt act that is a violation of the laws of war. But that's just a plurality of the court. Justice Kennedy didn't join that part of the opinion. He didn't agree with it. He just said, I don't think we have to go that far yet.
Yeah. Now, we only have eight justices voting on this. How come?
Because Chief Justice Roberts participated in this case when he was at the lower court, the Court of Appeals, and that judgment was reversed by the United States Supreme Court today.
So he had to recuse himself
in
this one. Well, thank you very much, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg.
Thank you.
To recap, the Supreme Court ruling against the Bush administration and its proposed military tribunals for detainees at Guantanamo Bay, the court said the president overstepped his authority and that the tribunals are illegal under U.S. law and the Geneva Conventions. We'll have more on this court decision later this hour.
Many leaders of the Palestinian government are in jail today. Israel arrested dozens of political leaders from the Palestinian group Hamas. The list of detainees includes eight members of the cabinet. These arrests come at the same time that Israel continues its military moves in and around the Gaza Strip. And all these moves came after an Israeli soldier was captured. NPR's Linda Gradstein is in Ramallah this morning, and she joins us now. And Linda, what are Israeli officials saying about the arrests of these Hamas officials? What's their purpose here?
Well, Israeli officials say that they're not arrested as bargaining chips to exchange for the soldier. They say that it's part of an operation against a terrorist organization, Hamas. The officials say that these people who were arrested will be investigated, brought before a judge, and that they will be charged. However, both Israeli and Palestinian analysts say that it is part of a move to increase pressure on militant groups like Hamas and the Popular Resistance Committees to try to pressure them to free the Israeli soldier. Israel says that they believe that Hamas is holding the soldier. The military wing of Hamas is one of three groups that claimed responsibility for the raid on Sunday that killed two Israeli soldiers and led to the capture of the third.
How significant is it now that a substantial chunk of the government of the Palestinian Authority is in jail?
Well, the question is, you know, how is this government going to function? Now, I just spoke to an advisor who's very close to Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, and he said, well, the government wasn't functioning to begin with, so what's the difference? But it certainly led to a lot of anger here. On the day-to-day level, Palestinians are saying the schools will stay open, doctors, you know, hospitals will stay open, but you can't have a government functioning long-term without any officials in it. And apparently about 87 senior political and military officials have been arrested, and Hamas officials are calling it, quote, an open war against the Palestinian government and people, and warning that Israel will pay the consequences.
You mentioned a lot of anger in Ramallah, where you are. What exactly are you seeing on the streets?
People are both angry and worried. They're angry at Israel partly because of the arrests, but also because Israel has hit civilian infrastructure in Gaza. About 700,000 people in Gaza are without electricity. Some of them are without water. So there's the sense that Israel is kind of stepping up the pressure, but also escalating the situation. People here are certainly worried of the repeat of an Israeli invasion, like Israel invaded Ramallah in 2002 at the height of the Intifada. But they're more concerned about what's going on in Gaza. And a lot of Palestinians have said that what Israel is doing has actually increased Palestinian unity and support for the Hamas government.
And let's talk about what could be seen as an escalation on the other side. Recently, an 18-year-old Jewish settler disappeared. Now he's been found dead near you. What happened?
That's right. Here in Ramallah, one of the neighborhoods during the night, his body was found by Israeli soldiers after Israel had arrested some Palestinians who they thought were involved in the kidnapping. And Palestinian gunmen from the Popular Resistance Committee said that they were the ones who had executed the 18-year-old Jewish settler. He was apparently captured while he was hitchhiking from one part of the West Bank to another, and Israeli officials have called on teenagers not to hitchhike. It's actually a very common way of transportation, and there's a lot of anger in Israel over his killing and a lot of, you know, hopes that the Israeli soldier will not be killed. At the same time, Palestinian officials say that Israel's escalation makes it harder to free this soldier.
Okay, that's NPR's Linda Gradstein in Ramallah. Linda, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
And this is AM 580 WILL Urbana. We stayed with Morning Edition a little longer than we usually do this morning. And we will be staying with National Public Radio so that we can bring you coverage from NPR of press conference by President Bush. The Prime Minister of Japan is visiting. He will be there alongside the President. And we are certain the President will have some comments about the decision by the Supreme Court that was just announced not long ago. The court has ruled that the President overstepped his authority in creating military war crimes trials for hundreds of inmates at Guantanamo. More on that just a moment when we join National Public Radio for that live coverage. We will expect to be doing the show that we had scheduled for the second hour of Focus 580. We'll be talking with Bill Buford. He's a writer for The New Yorker magazine, and he's just authored a new book that's about his experiences working in the restaurant kitchen of the celebrated Italian chef Mario Batali. The book is titled Heat, and it grew out of an experience that Buford had when he met Batali. He wrote a profile of Batali for The New Yorker, and then Buford said he asked himself this question: could he make it as a professional restaurant cook? And the book is about that experience. So you can hear that in so what would be the second hour of Focus 580. We also would like to remind you that we're continuing to raise money that will support next year's programming here on WILL. Our listener support goal, $900,000. And we have to meet that by the end of the month, and that's tomorrow. We still have $72,000 to go, and we hope that you will help us out. Protect something you value. You can call and make a contribution at 217-244-9455, or you can log on to willpledge.org and make a contribution that way. In either way you do it, it's a very important investment in the future of this service that we know you value, and we appreciate it very much. Right now, we're going back to National Public Radio for coverage of this morning's press conference by President Bush. 1021.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this morning, the Supreme Court issued a sharp check to the Bush administration. In a closely watched case, the court rejected the administration's effort to use military tribunals to try some of the men held as enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay on war crimes charges. The vote was 5-3. Justice John Paul Stevens wrote the majority opinion and found the proposed trials violated both U.S. law and the Geneva Conventions. In a separate opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy, regarded as the swing vote on the court, wrote, quote, "Trial by military commission raises separation of powers concerns of the highest order." In a dissent, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote that this decision will sorely hamper the president's ability to confront and defeat a new and deadly enemy. The court's willingness to second-guess the political branch, as Thomas added, is both unprecedented and dangerous. The case centers on a Yemeni national named Salim Ahmed Hamdan, who worked as a driver and bodyguard to Osama bin Laden. It directly affects a few dozen of the 400 or so detainees at Guantanamo, men the government proposed to try for war crimes. But the ruling speaks more broadly to presidential powers in time of war and comes amid a national and international debate over the future at the prison of Guantanamo Bay and the detainees. There's also the important political context of the war on terror and the looming midterm elections. President Bush is expected to be asked about the case when he holds a joint news conference with visiting Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi in 10 minutes or so. We'll bring you the news conference live. But first, let's find out more about the case, the ruling, and its implications. With me here in Studio 3A are Ari Shapiro, NPR correspondent, Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, and Jackie Northam, who's NPR's national security correspondent. And Ari Shapiro, let's begin with you. I know you've been looking at this case. Actually, two decisions from the court today.
Well, there were two main issues before the court. The first question the court had to answer was, did Congress take away the court's authority to hear this case? The court unsurprisingly said it had the authority to hear this case. And then the second, more substantive question dealt with these military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. And the question was, are the military tribunals legal? As you mentioned, Justice Stevens said for the majority that they are not legal. They violate both U.S. law and the Geneva Conventions. The case dealt with Salim Hamdan, who was the driver for Osama bin Laden. He's been held at Guantanamo Bay for more than 4 years now. And the question was, did the system that the president set up to try Hamdan and others on war crimes charges meet the standards required? Stevens said in his majority opinion, even assuming that Hamdan is a dangerous individual who would cause great harm or death to innocent civilians given the opportunity, the executive nevertheless must comply with the prevailing rule of law in undertaking to try him and subject him to criminal punishment. That prevailing rule of law is both the Geneva Conventions and the standards for military tribunals.
Now, the separation of powers issue, where does that come in?
Well, Congress had passed legislation known as the Detainee Treatment Act, which the government argued stripped the courts of ability to hear challenges to these tribunals. The courts overturned that. The courts disagreed with that argument, rather, and said they did have the authority. So essentially, you have the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch all duking it out over this issue. And today, the judicial branch has stepped in to have the final word. Now, it's important to note that this ruling does not talk about whether Guantanamo Bay will be shut down. It doesn't talk about whether or not the detainees there will be tried. It talks about how they will be tried and whether the system that exists now meets the minimum legal standard.
Now, this all follows upon an earlier decision a couple of years ago. Famously, I think it was Justice O'Connor who said in that decision that there is no blank check for the administration. That's a phrase that also came up in this case again.
That's right. The question there was, does the president have the authority to hold detainees indefinitely? The answer was no, but there were a lot of specifics missing from that opinion. So this case sort of revisits the question in a different context and says, when the president decides to try these folks, what are the standards that the president has to meet in those trials?
What due process, what standards of justice, do they get their attorneys, do the attorneys get access to materials, all of these questions.
Exactly, and now we know the standards are A, the Geneva Conventions, and B, the standards for military tribunals.
Getting back to the separation of powers issue, wasn't there an argument as well that by setting up military tribunals, an appeal to the verdict of a military tribunal goes to the Secretary of Defense and then ultimately to the President of the United States, so that's all contained contained within the executive branch. There's no judicial oversight.
Exactly. The opponents of these tribunals said the president is essentially making himself judge, jury, and executioner. On the other hand, the government said the United States is giving its enemies in wartime more privileges, more opportunities to challenge their detention than anyone in the history of war. This, however, is an unusual war in that it could go on for decades, generations even.
Yeah, we're, by the way, if you just tuned in, we're expecting President Bush shortly to emerge, I believe, in the East Room of the White House. Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi is visiting Washington, D.C. Yes, they're going on to Memphis and Graceland tomorrow, but right now he's visiting Washington, D.C. They're about to hold the standard joint news conference of considerable more interest today because of the Supreme Court's ruling in the Hamdan case, a sharp setback to the Bush administration's proposals to try some of the men held at Guantanamo Bay on war crimes charges. And that brings us to NPR national security correspondent Jackie Northam. And as Ari was saying, this doesn't dispose of the cases of these men at Guantanamo Bay. What happens to them now?
Well, the problem is they wait a little bit longer again now, because what we think might happen is that the military will go back and tinker with some of these rules for the tribunals. But, you know, as we were talking about, there's always been a problem. I mean, what drove this case today certainly was just there's always been a question of full and fair trial for these men. As you were talking about, the president at the end of the day is judge, jury, everything. And at the end of the day, even if these men are found innocent, they still have the right. The government still has the right to hold them down there. There's been huge problems with, you know, the whole trial system. And I'm not talking about from human rights groups or civilian lawyers. I'm talking within the JAG Corps. The military lawyers themselves are just outraged at how this is carried on, because the Uniform Code of Military Justice to them is one of the best systems. And they feel that what's been done here is the whole system has been turned on its head. So I think this would probably be a great, you know, a great victory for them as well as but at the end of the day, we don't know what's going to happen with the detainees now.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would this tribunal, as proposed, what would it have entailed? What would have been unfair in these?
Right from the very beginning, it's the president decides who's going to, you know, be the judge, the jury. Look, I sat in on the first few tribunals, and you saw right from the very beginning the appointing authority of all the commissions here said, "We'll just have to see how this plays out." Well, you don't just see how law plays out as people are going to trial, but that set the tone for all of these commissions. And so they tinkered with the new rules. They tinkered with the makeup of the jury, which they didn't call a jury. They decided later on that it'd be a judge rather than a presiding officer. All these things. They're allowed hearsay evidence into court. The lawyers, the defense lawyers, couldn't get a lot of the evidence. Just these things that, you know, we take for granted that, you know, when you walk into a court are there, or even a POW were granted. And it wasn't present at these trials.
Now, the Geneva Conventions that this ruling today says the procedures violate. What procedures does that have for trying prisoners of war, it's what it addresses, for war crimes trials?
Well, quite a number of things. And I mean, certainly one of the things is due process as well. There are things like, you know, access to evidence, that sort of stuff, a quick trial, everything like that. And that was not included. It took 2.5 years to even get the first person to end up in court, which was Hamdan. His was the first out of the gate. So, you know, you talk to several lawyers, military lawyers, they say, we don't know if we're ever going to see commissions, you know, take place, see the end of a commission. So we don't know what's going to happen.
Well, Salim Hamdan's case, he gets immortalized in the U.S. canons of law simply because his case was first out of the gate?
That's right, yeah. That's it. But you know what? I mean, as you said at the very beginning, this means so much more, this decision today, the future of Guantanamo in many respects as well, and certainly the way that the government's handling the war on terror.
Yeah, let's bring Ron Elving in at that point. And Ron, this does come in the context of, yes, the debate over Guantanamo, but this broad debate, which we heard reprised in the hearings for President Bush's Supreme Court nominees over the president's powers, especially in times of war.
I think it's clear that this decision will have a potential impact, at least, on the anti-terror tactics and philosophy of the administration across the board. We don't know exactly how it will apply, for example, to questions of handling detainees and people who are taken prisoner, perhaps in Iraq, and then taken by a process called extraordinary or extreme rendition to other countries where they may or may not have been subjected to torture or at least to some sort of humiliating treatment. That's a very hot issue. The Senate has debated that and put language regarding that into its legislation affecting the war in Iraq last winter. John McCain, the senator from Arizona, was a big champion of having that kind of restraint. And the administration argued at that time that in the same fashion that they felt they could deal with the detainees who were at Guantanamo, under their own rules, rules that essentially were brought to the fore by the administration itself, sui mm-hmm. generis, if you will, in the wake of 9/11, with the attitude that this was an entirely different kind of war and was not subject to the restraints of the Geneva Convention as a normal war would be. That whole philosophy, that whole approach to dealing with the war on terror is under pressure from this from this particular decision today.
Mm-hmm. We're told that we can now expect to see President Bush and Prime Minister Koizumi in about 2 minutes' time. Before we get there, let's ask Ari Shapiro one more question about today's ruling. Does it in any way say, we know it says, the procedures you propose to use, they're illegal, you can't use them. Does it then go on to say what you should use? Does it prescribe something that the government could now follow?
Yes, it says you have to meet a basic legal standard that conforms to both the Geneva Conventions and the laws for military, the Code of Military Justice, rather. Those are both lengthy documents, but they're very explicit documents, and one need only read them to see, you know, points A through Z, what standards have to be met for any trials of Guantanamo detainees going forward from here.
And briefly, Ron Elving, paying attention to the Geneva Conventions, this is something the president has been hearing from his critics for, well, how long has Mr. Hamdan been held? Four and a half years now.
It's been a subtext to the entire debate over our war in Iraq, as well as the war in Afghanistan. A lot of the prisoners who were at Guantanamo came from that particular war. But I'd like to add one other note as we go to the president's press conference. This is actually a prearranged news conference with the Japanese prime minister. There will be two questions asked by the American reporters, two questions asked by the Japanese, and this is not a wide-open news conference.
The reporters are gathered in the East Room of the White House, the area of the White House where state dinners are held, a very formal area, and they're awaiting the arrival of the president and the prime minister. And again, the Japanese prime minister is on a farewell visit. His term of office in Japan is about to expire. He's not running for another term. So this is he has had a close relationship with President Bush over the years, and this is an opportunity to say farewell. And obviously, George Bush has been as closely tied in Asia to Prime Minister Koizumi as he has in Europe with Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain, important allies, supporters, both of them, in Iraq and the war on terror. Japan, unprecedented for its post-war behavior, sent troops to Iraq to participate in nation-building, not in warfare. But anyway, we've just heard the announcement, and here
Thank
are President
all.
Bush.
Please be seated. Mr. Prime Minister, as I said on the South Lawn, we are delighted to have you here in Washington. The Prime Minister and I have got a very friendly relationship. We've just had 2 hours of discussions. We talked about a lot of areas of mutual concern. I've reminded the Prime Minister, the American people, Mr. Prime Minister, over the past months that it was not always a given that the United States and America would have a close relationship. After all, 60 years we were at war. 60 years ago we were at war, and today we talked about North Korea and Iran and Iraq and trade and energy cooperation. It's an amazing fact that we're able to have these discussions. It shows the power of liberty and democracy to transform enemies to allies and to help transform the world. And one thing about the Prime Minister is he understands that. He's a firm believer that in universal values. He believes in freedom, and he's willing to act on those beliefs. And we have been a strong partner in peace, Mr. Prime Minister. You've had a remarkable tenure as the Prime Minister of your country. You have led with courage. You have made hard decisions. You've helped us change our relationship so that Japan and the United States will be able to work even closer together in the 21st century. You made the hard decision to help realign our troops in your part of the world to better accommodate the needs of the Japanese people and at the same time keep in position a relationship that will be necessary for peace and stability. I want to thank you for opening your markets to U.S. beef. I think the Japanese people are going to like the taste of U.S. beef. Matter of fact, I had a good slice of beef last night, and you told me you did as well, and you look like you're feeling pretty good.
Yes, very good.
Yeah, right, good. We had an interesting discussion about energy. I mean, one of the things that Japan and the United States can do is we can help provide technologies that will improve the climate as well as reduce our dependence on hydrocarbons. We discussed the nuclear suppliers group that we're part of and our contributions to some research and development that will help speed up fast breeder reactors and new types of reprocessing so that we can help deal with the cost of globalization when it comes to energy, make ourselves more secure economically as well as make us less dependent on hydrocarbons from parts of the world that, you know, may not agree with our policies. We, as I mentioned, we discussed Iraq and Afghanistan. By the way, the Japanese Defense Forces did a really good job when they were in Iraq, and they're able to leave because they did such a good job. And now the Iraqis will be running the province in which the Japanese forces used to be. Nevertheless, the Prime Minister, as he mentioned in the comments, will continue to provide airlift capacity and naval help. The North Korean issue is one, obviously, that's got everybody's attention now. And we discussed this issue in length. We both agreed that it's very important for us to remain united in sending a clear message to the North Korean leader that, first of all, launching the missile is unacceptable. There have been no briefings as to what's on top of the missile. He hadn't told anybody where the missile's going. Now, he has an obligation, it seems like to me and the Prime Minister, that there be a full briefing to those of us who are concerned about this issue as to what his intentions are. That makes sense, doesn't it? That's a reasonable thing for somebody to do. We talked about the six-party talks and to make sure we remain bound up and sending a clear message to the leader in North Korea. I also talked about one of the most touching moments of my presidency when the mom of the abducted daughter came to the Oval Office and talked to me about what it was like to have a young daughter abducted by the North Koreans. And it really broke my heart. I told the Prime Minister it was a moving moment for me. I just could not imagine what it would be like to have somebody have taken, you know, my daughter, or one of my daughters, and never be able to see her again. And the woman showed such great courage, Mr. Prime Minister, when she came and shared her story with me. It took everything I could not to weep listening to her. It also reminded me about the nature of the regime. What kind of regime would kidnap people? Just take them offshore, you know. What kind of person would not care about how that woman felt? And so we talked about the need to work together to bring a resolution to this issue about nuclear weapons. And I reminded the Prime Minister, he didn't need reminding, but I will share with him once again my deep concern about the human condition inside North Korea. He shares that condition. After all, he's the Prime Minister of a country that has suffered a lot as a result of abductions. And so we spent time talking about abductions. All in all, it was a visit that I knew was going to be a good one because I know the man. I know what he's like. He's a good thinker. He's a strategic thinker. He's a clear speaker. And plus, as you all know, it's become quite well known that we're going to end the visit at Graceland tomorrow. He's an Elvis fan. Now, Laura and I gave him a jukebox as a gift. And I can't remember. What was the first song you put on? It wasn't Hound Dog, it was...
I Own Chinese, I Love You.
Yeah. See, he loves Elvis. And I couldn't think of a better way to honor my friend by going to Graceland, but it also sends a signal about how close our relationship is. And so, Mr. Prime Minister, we're glad you're here. Thanks for your friendship, thanks for your alliance, and thanks for your leadership.
ありがとうございます。
Thank you very much. With President Bush, I had a very candid exchange of views over the past 5 years. I really had close friendship with President Bush, and thanks to that, we've been able to have very candid exchange of views. And I believe this is not just limited to close relations between us and personally, but I believe this close relationship is necessary in the future between Japan and the United States as well. Japan and the United States is in a Japan-U.S. alliance in the world, and we can reconfirm that we can cooperate with each other on various challenges. Maintain Japan's security and deterrence, and reduce burdens on local communities. On these points, we were able to have a very important agreement, and we're most grateful for that. And in the meeting, we discussed not just Japan-U.S. bilateral relations, but numerous challenges that the world community faces today. Afghanistan, North Korea. Poverty reduction, reduce poverty for people who suffer from various diseases. We shared common perception, and by doing so, we'll be able to cooperate with each other. Now, Japan, in a way different than the U.S., has been supporting the nation-building in Iraq by the Iraqis themselves. The ground salt defense forces stationed in Samawa, having accomplished their mission, will be withdrawing. But as a responsible member of the international community, through cooperation with various countries concerned and through cooperation with the United Nations, Japan will continue to provide support and help the Iraqis get back on their feet. With regard to North Korea, we spent a lot of time, and I expressed my views, and President Bush also expressed his thoughts. President Bush was kind enough to meet with Mrs. Sakie Yokota, and he told me he was very moved on that occasion. Anyone, if one's daughter is abducted, naturally would be grieved. And this feeling need to be shared by Americans and Japanese. We discuss that sort of thing. We do have the six-party talks, a framework. Japan and the United States, I believe, need to maintain close coordination and encourage North Korea to become a responsible member of the international community. With regard to Iranian nuclear proliferation, Japan also is concerned about this problem. The United States attaches importance to cooperation with EU and other countries concerned. Japan certainly supports that U.S. stance of seeking resolution through a dialogue regarding the nuclear proliferation issue. The Iranian issue remains a grave issue for the entire world economy, and Japan wishes to cooperate with the United States and other countries concerned on this matter as well. On UN reforms, building on the results achieved so far, we would like to work out with the G4 a proposal that can be supported by the United States and achieve reforms of the United Nations and the Security Council. Japan and the United States will maintain close coordination and partnership. We need to do that and address various challenges. The Japan-U.S. alliance is not just an alliance for our two countries. It is an alliance for the world, and in the interest of the world, we were able to confirm that we need to cooperate with each other. And I think this was a very substantive, fruitful meeting. And I would like to thank President Bush and the U.S. For a very warm hospitality and welcome.
We've agreed to take two questions aside. Walking in, I reminded the Prime Minister of one of Elvis's greatest songs, "Don't Be Cruel." So keep that in mind, Hunt, when you ask your question.
Thank you, Mr. President. You've said that you wanted to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, but you were waiting for the Supreme Court decision that came out today. Do you intend now to close the Guantanamo Bay quickly? And how do you deal with the suspects that you said were too dangerous to be released or sent home?
Yeah, I thank you for the question on the court ruling that literally came out in the midst of my meeting with the Prime Minister. And so I haven't had a chance to fully review the findings of the Supreme Court. I want to assure you that we take them very seriously. Two, that to the extent that there is latitude to work with the Congress to determine whether or not the military tribunals will be an avenue in which to give people their day in court, we will do so. The American people need to know that this ruling, as I understand it, won't cause killers to be put out on the street. In other words, there's not a as I was a drive-by briefing on the way here, I was told that this was not going to be the case. At any rate, we will seriously look at the findings, obviously. And one thing I'm not going to do, though, is I'm not going to jeopardize the safety of the American people. People got to understand that. I understand we're in a war on terror, that these people were picked up off of a battlefield. And I will protect the people and at the same time conform with the findings of the Supreme Court. And so, well, I haven't had a chance to fully review what the court said, Terry. I wish I had. If I could have given you a better answer. As I say, we take the findings seriously. And again, as I understand it now, please don't hold me to this, that there is a way forward with military tribunals in working with the United States Congress. As I understand, certain senators have already been out expressing their desire to address what the Supreme Court found, and we will work with the Congress. I want to find a way forward. In other words, I have told the people that I would like for there to be a way to return people from Guantanamo to their home countries, but some of them, people need to be tried in our courts. And that's the Hamden decision was the way forward for that part of my statement. And again, I would like to review the case, and we are. We got people looking at it right now to determine how we can work with Congress, if that's available, to solve the problem.
On North Korea, I'd like to ask a question of both of you, Prime Minister and President. On North Korea, I understand you spent a lot of time to exchange views. It is said that the North Koreans are preparing to launch a Tepudong 2. To resolve this missile issue, what kind of cooperation do you think is possible between Japan and the United States? Did you discuss the possibly referring the matter to the UN Security Council? On the abduction issue and human rights issue, I understand, Mr. President, you've shown deep concern for the resolution of the abduction issue. What sort of cooperation do you think is possible between the U.S. and Japan?
You want to go? Yeah, please.
Well, the North Koreans, I believe in the first place, we need to try and approach the North Koreans not to launch Tepudong 2 through various efforts. Should they ever launch the missile, that will cause various pressure. We would apply various pressures, and we discussed that. I believe it is best that I do not discuss what specific pressures we were talking about. As we approach the North Koreans, we shall maintain close cooperation and coordination with the United States, including the abduction issue.
All kinds of opportunities, and you know, the UN is an opportunity to express our common concern. You know, another interesting opportunity is over time to work on missile defenses. The Japanese cannot afford to be held hostage to rockets. And neither can the United States or any other body who loves freedom. And so one really interesting opportunity is to share and cooperate on missile defenses. The leader of North Korea is just going to have to make a decision. Does he want to be isolated from the world, or is he interested in being an active participant in kind of the nations of the world who care about their people and desire peace? It's his choice to make. We've made our choice. We believe it's important for nations such as Japan and the United States to be active participants in the world in a positive way, and that's what we're doing. You know, a lot of the focus of our relationship is based upon, obviously, Iraq and Afghanistan, but the truth of the matter is Japan and the United States make mighty contributions to end suffering because of disease and hunger. And that's why I appreciate the Prime Minister's leadership. He understands that with economic might comes serious responsibilities in the world, and the United States takes those responsibilities seriously, and so does Japan. Matt.
Yes, Mr. President, we can assume you've at least been given some of the broad strokes of the Supreme Court's decision on Guantanamo.
Well, I just gave you the answer on that. I'd be glad to answer another question.
Well,
on I gave you the broad strokes I've been given.
Right, but this can you comment on what looks like a judicial repudiation of your administration's policy on the treatment of terror suspects post 9/11?
Matt, I wish I could comment on Wood. Obviously, I'm a person who generally comments on things. I haven't been briefed enough to make a comment on it, except for the following things. I'm sorry you had to waste your question, but we will conform to the Supreme Court. We will analyze the decision. To the extent that the Congress is given any latitude to develop a way forward using military tribunals, we will work with them. As I understand, a senator has already been on TV. Haven't seen it, hadn't heard what he said, but as they briefed me and said, he wants to devise law in conformity with the case that would enable us to use a military tribunal to hold these people to account. And if that's the case, we'll work with him. But, that's I can't comment any more than I have just done in the first question. Otherwise, I would have. I just hadn't been fully briefed enough to answer your question, Matt.
Fuji Television. Over the past 5 years, Prime Minister Koizumi and President Bush have built up the best sort of relationship between the two of you in the history of Japan and the United States. What is the greatest reason for having maintained this policy of attaching greatest importance to Japan-U.S. relations? A question for President Bush. Various problems have occurred after 9/11, and in the Prime Minister Koizumi's policy of attaching importance to Japan-U.S. relations, what was the case, instance, where you were most appreciative of Prime Minister Koizumi's position, and what sort of impact has it had on your feeling and stance toward Japan? Well, attaching importance to our relations with the United States, well, after the Second World War, throughout over the past 60 years, Japan has maintained that policy. We've recognized the importance of Japan-U.S. alliance and also maintain the stance of international cooperation and coordination. It's because we have learned the lessons of World War II. We took up this policy, believing that this was good for Japan in the past, today, and the future as well. Maintain Japan-U.S. alliance and international cooperation. This is a very important fundamental policy of Japan that should never change. Last year, President Bush visited Kyoto in Japan, and we had one-on-one meeting. Some seem to think that to the extent Japan-U.S. relations is undermined, that could be complemented by better relations with Asia and other countries. And I said I will do not subscribe to that view. The better the Japan-U.S. relations, my view is that we will be able to have better relations with China and other countries in Asia. Now, some in the mass media took up on that and misinterpreted my position. In other words, they thought that I was saying to the extent Japan-U.S. relations remain good, I couldn't care less what Japan's relations would be with other countries. That is not at all what I said. I've been saying that there is no country in the world that has as important bilateral relations as Japan-U.S. bilateral relations. But I have no view such as having better relations with the United States at the expense of relations with other countries. My view is that by having better relations with the United States, I can have better relations with other countries. And from that perspective, in the post-war years, and Japan has achieved remarkable growth and development. It is because we've learned lessons from the past in our relations with the United States and determined to maintain friendly relations with the United States. And that is what we have done to date. In the future as well, Japan-U.S. alliance is something that will be contribute to the resolution of various challenges in the world by maintaining friendly ties between Japan and the United States. Attaching importance to our relations with the United States and does not sacrifice our views, relations with other countries. Please not misunderstand.
It's a pretty tricky question. I hate to point out one area where that has influenced my thinking about Japan's contributions for fear of diminishing the contributions in other areas. Because the truth of the matter is we live in a very complex world, and by cooperating to solve problems, it makes the world a better place. However, since you asked, I'll answer. I would think it is the Prime Minister's understanding of the capacity for democracies to help kind of change the conditions of the world, and therefore his strong support for helping a new Afghanistan democracy grow, and his willingness to do something a lot of other leaders in Japan have been unwilling to do, which is to commit self-defense forces to help the growth of a new democracy. And I tell the American people this. I use the Prime Minister all the time in my speeches. This press corps will tell you, they're incredibly bored of hearing. But nevertheless, I do share the example with the people about my relationship with the Prime Minister. It is just, it strikes me.